So good morning, and I'd like to acknowledge the presence of, I guess, my two interviewees who I interviewed for this project, Paula Kierstead and Jim Dirksen. So I'd like to thank you here for joining, and I'd also like to acknowledge the presence of April Dobbin. She's the Secretary of the Manitoba League of Persons with Disabilities, and I guess I'm the co-chair of the Manitoba League of Persons with Disabilities. So I mean, my presentation is on the Manitoba League of Persons with Disabilities. And the reason why I picked this project is that the organization is turning 40 years old or young, people could say that too, this year, and has a rich history of consumer self-representation as an organization advocating for the rights of persons with disabilities in the province of Manitoba. So 40 years ago, the MLPD, the Manitoba League of Persons with Disabilities, was known as the Manitoba League of the Physically Handicapped. I picked this particular project as it is important to me as a person with a disability. And as the co-chair of the organization, it was important to me to become more aware of the history of the disability rights movement in Manitoba. In this presentation, I interviewed Jim Dirksen and Paula Kierstead. Both Jim and Paula have played a significant role in the disability rights movement provincially, nationally, and internationally. Jim Dirksen was the first national coordinator of the Council of Canadians with Disabilities, or formerly known as the, if you can correct me on that, COPO, the Coalition of Provincial Organizations of the Handicapped, and that's going by pure memory, and in addition to also being a provincial coordinator for the Manitoba League of the Physically Handicapped. Both Jim and Paul went to university. So I'm going to start off by playing a little clip of Jim talking about his what it was like to grow up, his early years.
Well, I was born January 23rd, 1947. I was one of the first wave of the baby boom generation, the boomers. My dad had just gotten back from his military service in the Second World War, and it wasn't long after he got back that I was conceived, and my parents married, and I was the first of nine children to come.
So Jim also went here to the University of Winnipeg, and during his time here, he was one of only two wheelchair users on campus. Paula Kierstead was born in 1954, so she's turning the big...
Hey, thanks watch out for that contract killer
one here. along with a twin brother, which they were prematurely born into a military family. As she was born prematurely, she had to spend several weeks in an incubator. And within the first couple of weeks of being born, in order to keep them alive, a doctor conducting research on this particular area experimented with the oxygen levels within their incubators. And as a result, she became visually impaired as what she calls a man-made disability. Since Paula grew up in a military family, she and her brother moved around a lot. While growing up, she had to deal with normal expectations, like everyone else did within her family. While attending school, she did her best to take down notes and would even go to the front of the class to see what she had missed or had her other classmates. Basically, she'd ask her other classmates to take down notes for her or ask her other classmates to fill her in. So I'm going to play her clip about being born and growing up.
My beginnings began on December 7th, 1954. And what's a particular note of that is that I was a two-month preemie twin. And my brother and I were born in the United States in Florida unexpectedly. We were to be born back in Canada when my parents left Florida and returned. In fact, my father was hoping it was going to be on his birthday in February. But my mother found out she was having twins the very week she went into labor, so we were quite the big surprise.
So Paula, at the young age of 7, decided that she wanted to go into physiotherapy. She got accepted into physiotherapy, but did not last long within the faculty at the University of Manitoba. And as a result, she went into social work, where she graduated with a Bachelor's of Social Work degree. Jim grew up in a working-class family, with his father working on the railroad as a laborer. While living with his aunt and uncle, they encouraged him to try new things and were more positive about his future. Three of his siblings got polio. He was the only one to have long-lasting paralysis. In 1953, his parents were lucky enough to buy polio insurance. As a result of getting polio, he spent about a year in the municipal hospital. He began to realize that things were different when he got home from the hospital, such as detecting that people were saying comments around him that he would not be able to raise kids or possibly spend the rest of his life at home being taken care by his parents. Both of them got involved in the Manitoba League of Persons with Disabilities in the 1970s. Dirksen, as in Jim Dirksen, talks about how he was able to secure funding for the Manitoba League to sustain his employment.
I was able to broker a project from the Company of Young Canadians, which was the federal government's response to the revolutionary sort of attitudes of a lot of the boomers who were dropping out of school and dropping acid and getting political. And this was, I was with them for, I don't know, maybe a year and a half. And my task was to organize the Manitoba community of people with disabilities. So that meant building the Manitoba League of the Physically Handicapped. When that ran out, I was able to develop some funding from the Winnipeg Foundation, a number of other sources, to carry on my job there.
So Paula Kierstead points out that by getting involved in the Manitoba League, she became more comfortable with the fact that she had a disability. So I'm going to play her clip.
In the end, though, it opened my mind to a lot of other things, and I pursued a lot of different areas as a volunteer or part-time work for that 1 year after leaving physio, and realized a common factor was social work. But in the meantime, I had already started getting involved with the Manitoba League, and when I first got involved in 1976, I think it was, 2 years after the league had begun, I was getting involved as this physio student who wanted to learn more about disabilities and help those folks out. I hadn't identified myself as potentially one of them. Not that I thought it was a negative thing, I just hadn't thought of it, because I had been normalized so much in my upbringing, you know. I didn't know the fights my parents had had with schools and stuff in the past and how they challenged professors to let us in or, you know, principals or whatever, because we traveled quite a bit with Dad being in the Navy. I didn't know about all that. So in the meantime, I connected with the league and they said, well, you know, there's also a camp that the Society for Manitobans with Disabilities runs. Maybe that's something you would find interesting as well, because it was all in the same building. So before I got too involved with the league in that first year, I actually got involved as a physio student with that camp and started to meet people with disabilities, children and adults, and provide assistance in summers. And it allowed me to see people as total people. Hey, they want to go on a boat ride just like anyone else. My whole instinct was, let's look at the full expression of every person. I don't narrow my perspective to one thing about them. So that got me in an interesting mode of thinking. And then when I met up with people like Henry Enns, because he was in the School of Social Work, and so was I. He didn't live far from me, so I started getting rides to university with him. He started talking up the league. And as we go to his university, he'd say, you know, have you heard of this group? And he had just found out about it. And I said, yeah, they're in the same building as this camp thing I do. And he said, yeah, you know, they're really looking at having folks develop concepts around the rights of people with disability to have access to everything and do all that they want to do in their life. And I said, oh, that's neat. Maybe I could help. And he said, well, come and attend some meetings. So eventually he got me on the membership committee, and then at one point he wanted me to chair that, and I said, what? I don't know anything about chairing, but I took it on. And I started to realize, you know, our world is inherently inaccessible to a lot of people in our society. And often that inaccess or ignorance is based on fear. And it really behooves us as citizens to understand each other's difference and to celebrate those different gifts. So I was working on different advocacy things, getting more people out there knowing their rights. The transportation issue had started, one of the big organizing elements for the league, about handy transit, so I learned all about that.
So interesting that Henry Enns' name comes up, because Paula was mentioning to me before we walked in here this morning that in fact it would be his birthday today. So that's just a coincidental, but she talks about Henry Enns and it's just his birthday today, too.
He would have been 71 today.
Yeah, 71 today. So that's just pure coincidence. So one of the biggest issues for the Manitoba League of Persons with Disabilities was advocating for the creation of a handy transit system here in Winnipeg. And probably, from my understanding, one of the first big issues that the league had to deal with. Jim Dirksen talks about the options that were available before handy transit.
For a person, a wheelchair user like myself, I could use a folding manual wheelchair and use taxis. I was able to transfer into the taxi and out of it on my own, and the driver would fold up my chair and put it either in the back seat or in the trunk. Of course, travel by taxi is quite costly, and I had a big monthly taxi bill to pay. People who use power wheelchairs were really in a hard way. There were a couple of charity-funded vans that had ramps, as I recall, in the early days, and they could be arranged to transport a power wheelchair user. Some power wheelchair users were able to use a manual wheelchair in some circumstances where they could actually transfer into a car, taxi or non-commercial car, and then someone else could fold up their manual wheelchair and put it in the trunk. And this was difficult for all but a very few power wheelchair users. People with spinal cord injuries, on the other hand, were assisted to learn how to drive cars with hand controls and to learn how to fold up ever lighter manual wheelchairs and stow them in the back seat. Usually this would be a two-door car with a seat, front seats that would go forward, so you could manage to slide a folded wheelchair behind. Very few people began to use lift-equipped vans and drive from their wheelchairs, which would be locked in behind the wheel. Government, meaning federal government, who had already agreed to certify and accept hand controls, provincial governments who had agreed to do drivers' testing and drivers' license provision to people who passed tests driving these kinds of modified vehicles. But it was in the very early stages, in the early 70s. Mobility was a tremendous problem. If you were a person with certain types of mobility impairments, trying to get to and from work, trying to get to and from jobs or schools was next to impossible.
Paula Kirstead talks about her involvement in support of those who are advocating for the creation of a handy transit service within Winnipeg. So I'll play her clip.
Well, I was a member of the group that worked on it and supported, you know, the folks who used or would need a transit service like that by, you know, attending meetings and talking strategy, going to any meetings where they needed extra voices. You know, there was this whole dilemma that on the regular transit bus, people who were blind and had their CNIB card would get on free, so that sort of got clouded in the discussion. And, you know, I had my own view on that. If someone was working and was bringing in their own income, I didn't think there was a need for that kind of automatic free pass because you can't see. So I was pretty uncomfortable with that, and that came up a little bit. But I saw myself as a strong member of the league who would support, you know, any initiative we're working on, including handy transit. So if we went to any rallies, if we went to any meetings, I would offer to go and support that. So I was there when the victory was won, and when Elizabeth Semkew, who was a staunch member of the committee and really helped push this agenda, when her picture was taken on one of the first handy transit buses. And what it did is it showed the league we do have collective power. We can influence things, and we can work together. And even if we're not, you know, using all the right educated language or whatever, we have a voice to be heard, and that we have the right to speak out. Because the whole cost of handy transit was the big resistance. You know, a double service, door to door, like what a privilege. And we had to do a lot of discussion around the concept of parallel accessible service that's geared to the needs, not to the wants of somebody. And we had to learn that ourselves and explain it to each other and then pass that on. So it was a great learning opportunity to figure out how to profess our philosophy and our beliefs as we were getting a hold of them ourselves.
A significant issue for persons with disabilities was having a voice in the services that they used. Many of the services were controlled by the non-disabled charity elite. Jim Dirksen and Paula Kirstead addressed the issue of why the disability rights movement organized a slate to take over the board of what was then known as the Society of Crippled Children and Adults, now known as the Society for Manitobans with Disabilities. Jim Dirksen starts off by making the case why the disability movement, rights movement, had to organize a slate to take over the board of the Society for Manitobans with Disabilities. So I'm just going to play the clip right now.
The rehabilitation industry did not think of itself as an industry. There were more people employed to serve the needs of disabled people than there were disabled people employed. And those that were employed to serve the needs of disabled people were almost 100% non-disabled people. And there was a social gap or canyon, you know, a great difference between the value put on the non-disabled versus the value put on the disabled. So it was almost akin to racial discrimination. The attitudes between the two. One had all the power, the other had none of the power, and so on. And there were, that was a comfortable place for the service providers to occupy. Not only did they have the advantage of reasonably well-paid jobs and status, they also were seen as morally superior. They were seen as self-sacrificing. By running these organizations that provided services to disabled people, they were seen to be almost philanthropic, self-sacrificing, morally superior to your average person. They weren't out there in the business world trying to make money, but they could be. No, they had chosen to take these lowly jobs serving people with disabilities. So they had a lot invested in their position. And I may have told you the story about when I went into the... There was a man who ran sheltered workshops in Ontario.
No.
Well, there was a federation of sheltered workshops. And there was one man who was the president and the leader. And he ran a big sheltered workshop in... I can't remember. An Ontario city, maybe it was... maybe it was Scarborough, or maybe it was one of the other cities. It wasn't Toronto itself. So I flew out there, and he had wanted to have some kind of relationship with our emerging national movement, because he was trying to move his organization into the national sphere as well. And when I went to the sheltered workshop, I came in the door, and I smoked tobacco at that time. I was smoking a cigar. And there was a small disabled woman behind the desk at the reception point. And she I said I wanted to see, I think his name was something like Roman, the manager. And I had an appointment with him. She said, oh, she was very surprised that I had an appointment with her manager, the non-disabled Major Domo there. And she said, she warned me, you better put your cigar out. Mr. Roman doesn't like cigar smoke at all. But I said, well, it's a very small cigar. I'm just going to keep smoking it, you know. So I was trying to defy the hierarchy. I was trying to manifest some equality with this man and so on. I was being impolite in modern terms. Not respecting his desire to be free of secondhand smoke. But those are all modern concepts. They didn't apply at the time at all. They had no currency. In any case, I waited for a while. I went in. He was there with his secretarial associate or employee. She was also, you know, a high status kind of secretary. And I used the word for the first time, rehabilitation industry. And I related my own constituency as being the consumer organizations who were essentially needing to be respected by the industry, because without us, they could not exist. And we were... the users of their services, and we had certain opinions and certain criticisms of their services. And I recall very clearly the look that went between the manager and his secretary when they heard that word, industry, vested interest, consumers. I mean, those were the days that Ralph Nader was just emerging in the States and validating the idea of consumer power. And it was a very political kind of framework that I put on what had been a charity kind of framework. And we had the same kind of struggle with the people that owned and ran the Society for Crippled Children and Adults. The board membership, I think I may have mentioned last time, was also the membership of the Charleswood Country Club, I think. Actually, I might get in trouble with this, but the current owner of the Jets he was the son of the man who had helped form the Society for Crippled Children and Adults in the early 50s. And he was with that particular country club. And when his dad retired, he inherited his seat on the country club board as well as the Society for Crippled Children and Adults of Manitoba. And so there was a tremendous struggle for us to have some control of that organization. It lasted 3 or 4 years. And they were resistant and outraged, in a way, that their position as part of the charity elite with the status, morally and otherwise, that accrued, should be usurped by these poor ragtag upstart disabled people. And I would say they played fair with us. They were very competitive. I think the man's name is Chipman. And I mean, they weren't maligning us. They simply continued to find more and more people to come to the annual general meetings in an attempt to continue to retain their board control. So we eventually met at the convention center because there was no room in any other hall at the annual meeting. But we eventually brought out more of our friends and relatives than they brought their friends and relatives and took over the board. So this sort of thing played itself out at CNIB and in almost all the other charity-based kind of service provider organizations. And they had evolved from depending mostly on charitable donations to providing government-funded public services under contract. So in other words, they were using tax dollars to provide the services, but they were the old charity elite who continued to manage and control and have the power. And they had considerable power over which tax dollar resources went to which disabled people. And we really needed to take them over so that we could have disability perspectives in terms of designing the programs and managing them. And it was a real struggle for about, 10 years. Eventually, we reached a point where we understood we had more influence than they did. And we took many strategic decisions to achieve that point. From a resistant, sort of reluctant, nobody likes to give over power voluntarily. And that was certainly proved out in our struggle to achieve ascendancy over the service providers. That's a time that has more or less gone by. Even though CNIB, I must say, still is primarily owned and controlled by the non-disabled charity elite, although there are a few good blind people in it. And maybe things are changing. I haven't actually met with them for a few years now.
So I also wanted to put Paula's experience on the record, too. So Paula also talks about her involvement in the SMD takeover. So she was also involved, and I do have a clip about her being involved, so I'm going to play her clip.
We were also trying to influence how the Society for Manitobans with Disabilities was being run because we felt it was very patronizing, and they were getting tons of funding on the backs of people with disabilities. So we wanted to, frankly, influence how that agency was running. So I was one of the slate of 11 in the late 70s who got nominated to their board, and we were going to take over and this and that. So while we're counting, you know, who's going to be involved in this element, and we were very adamant at these meetings that the predominant number of people were people with disabilities speaking out for ourselves. And I remember Jim Dirksen and I standing at the elevator. Well, he was sitting, I was standing, in the rehab hospital where we often had our meetings, which is ironic, but anyway. And we were getting ready to go to another meeting around the strategy about taking over, you know, SMD's board and stuff, okay? And I said, well, it looks like there'll be 10 of us there, and 9 people will have disabilities, something like that. I forget the exact numbers. And Jim says, well, you're going to be there, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, that's 10 for 10. I said, what? And he said, well, you have a disability. And I said, oh, yeah. I mean, I remember this going, duh, oh, yeah. And Jim said, yeah, you're one of us. You can count yourself. And I said, geez, you know what? I never put it in that perspective. Of course I can. Why not? And it was at that moment that it dawned on me, I can belong to this, you know, large, exciting, diverse group of people. There's no negative aspect to it. There's no positive aspect to it. It's just so. And then I started looking at my, who am I as a woman with disability? And that's when that whole process began for me.
Well, certainly this project, to this project, I developed a lot of reflections. And so I think one of the things is that the voice of persons with disabilities is not often on the public record. As all of you have noticed in this presentation, and in fact was referenced by Paula Kirsten, that the voice of persons with disabilities does matter in terms of influencing public policy. Many persons with disabilities feel that their voice is not heard in the public policy arena. I was affected by interviewing people in several ways. And one of the ways that I was affected is that many persons with disabilities face similar barriers to those who are active in the 1970s. Much like me, I also had to overcome barriers, and as a result, attitudes have changed. And sometimes attitudes reemerge and don't change too. It's quite apparent to me that the biggest struggle in the disability rights movement is to change social attitudes. It is when social attitudes change, it will be a time where people will not have to deal with barriers to participation in society. And I'm certainly willing to take any questions or comments or feedback on the presentation.
Thank you, girls.
Thank you.